Great. Okay. Good morning, everyone. I am the disembodied voice of Brendan Sharkey, chair of ACIR. This is the Local Government of the Future subcommittee meeting for Tuesday, January 24th. I know that John, the vice chair, John Filczek, will not be attending today. We have, I think, today a light but important agenda, if I can paraphrase it that way, where I think we kind of need to set a little bit of a direction and give folks a little bit of an update on what we're doing, but also set some direction on this. So if we were to follow the agenda that Bruce sent out, I don't know if there's anyone who has any comments or thoughts on the minutes that and the notes that Bruce has sent out previously about the last subcommittee meeting and the full ACIR meeting earlier this month. If you do, speak up, let me know, but otherwise we can kind of move through that agenda item. I know that John found the article about why state and local relationships matter in to national prosperity from the Brookings Institute. So I don't know if you had any thoughts about that. I know John wanted to have that as perhaps a topic for conversation, but because he's not here today, we may want to put that off. I don't know, unless folks have a particular thought about it. I thought it was an interesting article. I think it applies well to all states, actually, but it particularly is true in states that have. I think the point of the article was that increasingly, particularly in red states, that the major population centers of those states are generally governed by a different party and populated by a different party than what might be happening at the state level, which is a genteel way of saying we're talking about red states with blue cities. And I think, you know, there's a phenomenon that's occurring where in those states where state legislators are preempting local governments from doing proactive things that they need to do. And that's a trend that is troubling. And the overall point of the article is the importance of, I think, the collaboration between state and local to really maximize the potential for both. I think it's certainly relevant for Connecticut in terms of the, I think, as I say, it's important everywhere, the importance of state and local being able to work together, which is our function at ACIR. But I don't know if there's any other thoughts about that article that you thought were particularly insightful or helpful. Yeah, Rick.
Well, I really appreciate this article being distributed. I found it fascinating. And I think in our previous discussions, we bump up against this, at least indirectly. And I think it is within ACIR's purview to be thinking about these kinds of issues. Having said that, and people are welcome to push back, but you know, Connecticut's listed among the states with the most, the largest proportion of GDP coming out of metropolitan areas, which is probably not a surprise to anyone here. Brendan, you said it, you described the challenge, I think, well. I don't think it's as much of an issue in a place like Connecticut as it might be in some places that, again, I want to be careful that where there's a more even mix between metropolitan areas and rural areas. And So it's not, I would say it's not the urgent issue in Connecticut that it probably is in some other places. But it's important for us, I think, to keep an eye on it, because again, it is all about how municipalities relate to state governments. And that's, you know, that's where we can make a meaningful contribution. So I guess I'll just stop there.
Yeah, I think that's right. The more egregious examples that they offered were, you know, in Jackson, Mississippi, that has a failing, mm-hmm. which is a huge economic center for the state, yet the city itself has a failing water treatment system, and to try to get money from federal money through the state to actually do it is not being honored by the state government that's choosing to withhold those funds. And that kind of disconnect is really destructive, I think. I think the article's point is that's really a destructive trend if the state is not doing everything it can to support its one of its major economic drivers for the state, as well as, you know, its most populous city. So that's dysfunction at so many levels that it seems counterproductive, which is just going to be worse for the state as a whole over time. But you're right. I don't think that Connecticut necessarily. I think there's a we don't have the really stark difference between affiliation of state run of the government at the state level versus the city level in Connecticut, for good or ill. You know, they tend to be we tend to be a blue state both at the state and the local level, but at least at the city level. So that may not be as relevant for us, but yeah, it's a point that continuing the relationship between state and fostering the relationship between state and local is critical. So,
yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, Margaret.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that it reminded me of a John Grisham novel, the whole business with Jackson, you know, Mississippi.
Jim.
I guess I would wonder if really the heart of the discussion has to do with politics and the definition of politics being the art of compromise. I think we kind of have in Connecticut perhaps a reverse situation. Many of our towns or smaller towns, for example, are, I guess you would say, red towns. And the ideologies that seem to prevail in those towns, at least some of them, have hardened, and the typical political way of doing business and accomplishing things is starting not to work for in these sort of situations. So in terms of the article, it really the fact that we don't know how to do politics anymore, seems like.
Yeah, I think that's right too. Right. Yeah, Bruce.
Always takes me longer to unmute than to raise my hand. I just thought I would add, because I grew up just outside of Jackson and still have family there. An interesting thing not mentioned in the article is that the next city west of Jackson, Clinton, which is where I had lived, is currently under EPA order, not regarding water, but regarding sewer. because it's been a booming area, and Clinton and two nearby towns in the western half of that county are currently planning a new sewage system intended to attract industrial development to their area. And that system is going to depend on a 19-mile pipe to carry sewage from their treatment facility past the brook that they currently dump in to carry it to a river near where it flows into the Mississippi. And they are very pointedly not sending it east towards Jackson because they don't want to be involved in the larger Jackson metropolitan infrastructure issues. And they're looking at a price tag, you know, even before the normal kind of inflation of reality, they're looking at 100 million or more. And as best as I can tell from this distance, they're getting a lot of state government support and federal interest in splitting the infrastructure of central Mississippi even further beyond what it already is. And, you know, basically wow. Jackson's wastewater system is not in much better shape than the drinking water system. And so instead of looking for regional solutions, they're looking for using outside money in order to kind of insulate themselves.
Wow.
That problem, even though almost everybody in Clinton works in Jackson or otherwise depends on Jackson, you know, just like here, hospitals and all kinds of other things. So it's almost an anti-ACIR, anti-intergovernmental solution.
Wow. I mean, I'm sorry, but that the racial overtones with that, the classist overtones of that, there's so many overtones to that are embedded with that. That's frightening. Yeah. Yeah. Francis.
Thank you, Brendan. You know, we've seen similar things in the Northeast. The siting of the Tappan Zee Bridge was done to avoid having to work, you know, with the Port Authority.
Yeah.
And right. On the other hand, you know, regionalism is not always a panacea. Look what happened to Mira.
True. Right. Right. When it fails big time. Yeah. 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 Thanks for that. Interesting. Well, you know, with that, I kind of wanted to, that's sort of maybe a good segue to, and it seems like I did get my camera to work finally. It's a good segue into the next item on the agenda, which I think is really what for me is the critical task, I think, of this particular meeting with regard to our property tax reform proposal. Just to give you a bit of an update on where we are relative to earlier this month when we last met. I did contact the governor directly, I think actually at the last meeting. He and I spoke briefly about the proposal that we have produced. And suggested to him that this, basically what I think the history on this was that we were going to be producing this study at the suggestion and with the support of Mark Boughton at DRS. And Mark and I had sort of crafted the idea of bringing this to the governor at the beginning of his next, or the other, if this governor did not win re-election, whoever the new governor was, as at the beginning of their next term, to suggest that this is a legacy kind of thing. And maybe, you know, a big, bold proposals might be the order of the day, given the new start for a new administration, but also the availability and flexibility of funding that occurs right now that we happen to be blessed with in Connecticut, as opposed to what we've what we have had in the past. Let's put it that way. Maybe if not now, when? As I think I reported at the ACIR meeting, I gave the draft of our proposal before it was fully finalized to Mark Boughton with the idea that he would bring it to the governor's office and or to the governor directly. And what happened was it got essentially blocked by the governor's senior staff. As being, you know, out of the realm, too big, too much, too bold. Some of the things could be done, but, you know, the idea, the price tag was just a non-starter, was the way it was phrased. And I thought that that was a problem because I felt as though that maybe some of the, particularly for some of the staff who are more senior and more directly connected to the governor may not have some of that institutional memory of what we're talking about and why we're talking about it. You know, with all due respect to everybody who is working for the governor and for the governor himself, I think, you know, there are many, many within the membership of ACIR, I'm going to be fairly blunt in the comments I'm making here, who have some experience with this issue over the last 10 or 20 years, who know, or longer, and who know the history of this and what an opportunity we have right now. Some of the folks who are newer to state government may not really fully appreciate that. I'm being blunt, but so I felt it was important to go directly to the governor and present it to him personally. And frankly, bypass some of the senior staff who were sort of blocking this and saying, no, this is ridiculous. What are you talking about? it happens that my former executive assistant when I was speaker is now the governor's, one of the governor's executives and scheduler. And we had a little bit of back and forth. She was getting something lined up for me, but then she went on vacation and texted me that she had handed it off to the staff to get the schedule. And I was like, oh boy, that's kind of taking it back into the track it was before. So that's when I texted the governor again directly and just said, look, can we just talk? So he was very good about it. He called me within 5 minutes and said, what's up? You know, what's going on? Which is, if you know the governor, that's the way he is. You know, he's a very direct and frank kind of guy and doesn't like necessarily having protocols and other stuff get in the way of just a frank conversation. So we had a good conversation and I explained what we're doing and why. I had a good elevator speech opportunity, I think, to explain why special ed in particular was problematic, why equity among our towns is an important element of this, and why regionalizing and really emphasizing the COGS and RESCs as the future of how we should be delivering local services is a really, really important point. He got that and appreciated that, but he also asked for more backup, more of an explanation on two things in particular. One is, why is it that we have such a disproportionate reliance on the property tax in Connecticut? What is the reason for that? Because for obvious reasons, I mean, I think he understands that property taxes are a drag on our state. And our, you know, if we're talking about middle class tax cuts, there's no more middle class of a tax in Connecticut than the property tax. But he hadn't really, I don't think, sat down with the notion of why we rely so, why we have such high property taxes. I don't think that ever really, even though I think we've had many conversations with the governor and his staff about this phenomenon, he asked for a little bit more backup as to why. Why is it that Connecticut is the way it is? And then the second question was about special ed. And why is it that Connecticut is an outlier on special ed? Why is it that our towns and cities are so heavily, more heavily burdened by the special ed obligations than, say, other states? And, you know, what role can the state play in this? And we left it that I would get him a response to those questions. He was very clear that, you know, the notion of, hey, you know, we're flush with money right now. This is the moment, let's spend it. He rejected that pretty emphatically, you know, that today's surplus is tomorrow's deficit. And if you, which is a fair point, if you start obligating yourself to make certain obligations to cities and towns and, you know, all in an effort to make improvements, that becomes the obligation that gets cut down the road when deficit, when surpluses are not as generous as they are now. And it also is the kind of thing that can drive you into deficits if you are not careful about it. So, you know, that's a reasonable position to take, I thought. But the next step for him was a very brief summary of basically those three topics: why the property tax, why special ed, and also how we could do more on the regional side in terms of shared services. So all that was great. And so John Filczak and I have been kind of going back and forth a little bit on trying to put together that, you know, précis, if you will, for the governor that really not just sort of talks about it in general, but actually can give, can annotate a little bit of this, you know, the studies and the explanations for why this phenomenon is occurring in Connecticut on all three fronts, really. And so John and I are kind of going back and forth on this. I know John's been real busy with other stuff, as have I. So I'm trying to figure out how best to kind of frame that and present that to the governor in a concise, you know, one or two page document. But the other thing that I just, before I see your hand raised, Francis, let me just finish one other thought. I've also talked to some of the senior leadership in the General Assembly about this. And we've got some interest on this, but I haven't pursued it as aggressively as I probably should, because I think our theory on this is that we should have an informational hearing, perhaps with planning and development committee, as well as the finance committee, to lay out our recommendations and precede that hearing with a press conference with our friends and supporters within ACIR and the other organizations that support and contribute to ACIR to help make the point, and then that lead that into a informational hearing from there, so that this doesn't have to be entirely, and I think, frankly, it's probably better that it's not entirely reliant on the governor to move it, but rather have it be a legislative initiative with their support that the governor can join on to if there seems to be legislative support. Obviously, I've got a little bit more familiarity with with the legislative branch. And so I think maybe we can get somewhere with that. But I will need this committee's help to get the word out and to communicate with our friends, neighbors, and bring them to a what would be that type of a hearing, that type of a press conference, you know, and help really move the whole presentation forward and move the agenda forward on this. So later on in this meeting, we're going to also talk about next steps, I think, with the COGS and RESCs, which I know is another thing that John wanted to raise at today's meeting. But for now, staying on the topic of our property tax report, Francis, you had your hand raised, sorry.
Thank you for the thorough update, Brendan. I was going to say two things. One is I'm happy to volunteer my time to help provide information for that short presentation. I think many people, when they see the data about what an outlier Connecticut is, it's striking. I can't explain. We can tell the story very clearly with data. I'm happy to help out on that. The other thing is, yesterday I went through and reviewed all bills that have been introduced to date, this session, and there is a passel of bills on adjusting special ed, you know, changing the excess cost ratio or taking it over. Is the governor's office aware of all those bills?
I don't know. It was clear from my conversation with him, and this is not in any way casting aspersions, the governor's the governor. He's got a lot of things on his plate and can't be an expert in everything. But it was clear to me that he really did not have a clear understanding of special ed and its impact on towns and cities. I was explaining the excess cost grant to him and what that actually funds and what's the premise of it and all that. Which is totally legitimate. I'll take you up on your offer, Francis, to help with the data, right? Because I think that kind of data-driven explanation is precisely what we've got it, not just talking about it, you know, we should do this because it's good to do it, but having the actual data to back up, why is Connecticut an outlier on really all three of these functions, but particularly with regard to special ed and on property tax in general.
And if I may add, Brendan, it's interesting scanning through all the bills because it seems legislators on the special ed, it's the number two. The bills I saw on property tax largely would increase the property tax, which would only compound the situation.
Yeah. Do you know, Francis, do you happen to remember from your scanning those bills to which committees they were referred? Were they referred to finance or did it go to planning and development? Do you happen to remember?
I have to look at that again. I will look at it and I can scan through to get back to you by time today.
Okay. Because that may also dictate, you know, which committee is likely to take it up. Is that more of a P&D issue or is that going to be more, or an education in the special case of special ed? Which committee is going to take the lead on that topic? So, thank you. Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I wanted to say is that the history would be very interesting in terms of why property tax. I think that it goes back to colonial days and the British, I suspect. And, you know, if you remember, the Boston Tea Party was about taxes on tea. In the colonial days, taxes were levied on things that you owned, like cows and horses, etc. Land had very little value in the colonial days. And so people's property was their wealth. And municipalities, when they needed to raise taxes to do something, began to realize that the simple thing to do was to tax cows and horses and oxen and that sort of thing. Yeah. And that just proliferated. There really wasn't a mechanism, probably, I don't know, before World War II to tax sales tax and to tax income tax. So property was the simple thing that you could look at and count and tax. And I think that if we could figure out somebody who teaches a course in Connecticut economic history, must be somebody like that over at UConn or in one of the universities, somebody would know this really well, mm-hmm. and would point us in the right direction.
Yeah. Thanks. That's a good point. And maybe that becomes a subject for the informational hearing, you know, potentially, if we can get that far with a committee.
Yeah. So. The earlier in the summer or in the fall, when I was looking at the role that the state paid in paying for education, up until around 1950, the state was paying a huge chunk of the education cost, probably as much as 50 or 60%. And I think what happened is that the towns were left with the one ability to tax, the property tax, and the state went off and started using other taxes. And as those funds were, how do you say, scrutinized or people objected to those taxes, there was pressure to reduce or to keep them low and reduce them at the state level. And so the state started defunding education, and eventually, you know, the towns had to pick up that slack themselves with the only thing that they had, the property tax.
Right. And I think what would be useful then is also being able to do a comparative analysis of what other states do. And I, you know, the quick answer on that is, you know, in other states that have county government, the counties are the ones who pay for the schools. So it diffuses out over a larger geography, but it's an additional tax that another layer of taxation that, you know, that other states take advantage of to help fund education. But whereas in Connecticut, it's all, you know, it's all local. So, but yeah, thanks for that, Jim. Rick?
I'll be quick, and Brian's on the call too, and may have a different perspective or a fuller.
Yeah, but Rick, he's not on camera, so he doesn't get to speak.
but I'll do this quickly. So, and I know we're not going to try to figure out this whole the answers to all the governor's questions. I'll just say this: I take it in some ways as an encouraging sign that he talked to you, and that he thought it important enough to ask these additional questions. So I take this as a charge that we should all really work hard on and come back with concise but compelling answers. I'll just say this with regard to why we're an outlier. What Jim said, plus I do believe that, you know, if you look around the country at those comparisons that you just mentioned, the most reliance on the property tax tends to be in the Northeast. I know everybody on this call knows this. It's a historic thing. It's, I think, in large measure due to what Jim was talking about. We should look at that and understand that a little bit better. But, and it's also about the last thing that Jim talked about. We're an outlier on education funding. And that's why the special ed and the ECS is so important as a part of this solution. I hope we can stay with that over time, but we should make it clear to the governor and other leaders how much of an outlier we are, not only on the property tax, but on education funding. Last couple quick ideas. When you look at those state-by-state comparisons, a lot of states charge tolls or have utilities where the municipalities collect a lot of money for water, sewer, parking, things like that. That is one of the significant differences between us and states and other parts of the country. Something to consider, because that may come up in the conversation. I'm not advocating those things, yep, but it is a reason why we're different from other places. And the last thing I'll say, here again, Brian may have a fuller perspective. CCM has thought a lot about this over the years too. And I know that the This Is Different report a few years ago doesn't address that question specifically, but it does talk about how Connecticut compares to other states in terms of municipal spending, and the fact that we're actually on the lower end compared to most other states when it comes to municipal spending. These are things that could be helpful in any response to the governor. And I know we have to do it quickly, but Jim's right too. Is there somebody at one of our universities, somebody somewhere in the state who has made this part of their career and who really understands what the answer to at least the first question about property taxes?
I attended a meeting last week with Professor El Khadri about reestablishing an institute at UConn for just that purpose, which is, you know, fantastic, but you know, that's not going to help us in the next few weeks. but yeah, you're right. I think there have to be some people who can kind of help us articulate it well. And again, maybe in advance of a public hearing, an informational hearing, that would be the way to present the landscape a bit. Sam.
So I originally came from upstate New York, where they have county government, and the county government collects sales tax. And so there's a state sales tax and there's a county sales tax. Municipalities can opt out of the county sales tax and do their own, but then they don't get any money from the county. I think when you look at the three different forms of taxation that fund government in the country, it's income tax, it's property tax, and it's sales tax. Other states like New York have much higher sales tax. So they're paying for government services out of sales tax, whereas we're obviously more reliant on the local level on property tax because the municipalities don't have the ability to tax sales. When you look at what you're taxing, when you're taxing income, you're taxing, current wealth that you earn that year. When you're taxing property, you are taxing past wealth or wealth that you don't even own yet because you're still paying a mortgage. And then when you tax purchases, you're really taxing consumption. You're taxing the people who are buying clothes, buying things to use really right now. And there's different societal impacts of that. The lower income you are, the more of your income is spent on consumables, and you're paying a much higher burden on sales tax. If you're wealthier, you're spending a lot less on sales tax as a percentage of your income. So I think that needs to be taken into consideration, the various social impacts of these different types of taxation, and how one of the solutions that might be proposed is a higher sales tax. But who would be paying that is, I think an important question that will need to be discussed. And I think the most important thing that we need to discuss here is that, there's two sides of this equation. A mill rate is calculated based on the budget and the grand list. And so you can't only just talk about you know, how we tax. We really need to talk about how we spend as well. And that's where the RESCs and the COGS come in as vehicles of trying to reduce some costs. Like, we have increasing school costs, but a declining school population in many of our districts. And it's ridiculous that we can't do anything about it. I think the only way to really tackle the solution is a holistic one that covers costs in addition to how we collect those taxes, at what level, and in what form. So,
right. Yeah, thanks for that. Agreed. Yeah, Margaret.
Yes, thank you. I've been listening, and the issue with special education costs causes people, whoever they are, to go to a place that has enough money so that they can share the expense over the whole town, for example, like Greenwich or Weston or that kind of thing. So there are a lot of people who move there for that reason, because of special ed. If it were a statewide thing, you wouldn't have that kind of, you wouldn't be taking people with income out of the cities or whatever, and they would be able to stay in the more reasonably priced houses and kinds of things. So that would be one argument to stop the bleeding out of the cities. And the second issue is, I've been making such a good point with the first one, right? So the second one is probably the property tax is the property tax, because cities, towns can collect it. It's there. You know, nobody's getting fancy with it. So
right.
It's easy to collect. So,
and it's stable.
Yeah. So yeah. I don't know that that's the big problem, but I definitely think the special ed thing could be made more statewide and therefore reduce the bleeding out of the cities of the wealthier people.
Right, right. Agreed.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for all that. I think what the immediate, there are a couple of immediate tasks, I think, that present themselves to us. One is to prepare that kind of a, I described it as a précis for the governor on, you know, the questions that he's asking. So Francis, I will take you up on your offer to for the data, right? And just, it seems to me we should be able to articulate it pretty precisely and succinctly using data that compares Connecticut to other, either to other states or without getting too much into like the you know, all the historical reasons and all that stuff. Let's just present it the way it is right now in today's world. Why is Connecticut an outlier? That's to Rick's point. You know, why are we different than other states? I think that's what he wants to see. And I think if the governor can see that Connecticut is different for this reason and for that reason, we should do something about it. I think that will make that, I think will make the case to him. That's the first task. The second task, though, is to really, I think, ramp up the volume a little bit by reaching out directly to the legislature, because we're not gonna get the governor's office to be the champion of this. That I think is clear. I think the hope originally was that it would be embraced and as a kind of a legacy thing for the whoever the governor was for this upcoming term, all that. Yeah, I don't think that's gonna happen. I don't think I don't think there's an appetite for that just inherently, you know, with the current administration, but I think there's an appetite for it at the legislature. And I think it's the kind of thing that if the legislature actually led the effort and led the conversation for a multi-year kind of approach to this, I think the governor would be on board. So that next piece of this is getting in touch with the various committees and leadership, again, with the legislature, which, you know, I think maybe the way to do that is to schedule a few meetings with the chairs. I would probably start with the majority leader, Jason Rojas, who has a particular interest in these topics, but then continue with the other committees and committee leadership to see if we can put together a date and a time for an informational meeting at which the relevant committees would, to which the relevant committees would be invited. And that becomes the launch pad for potential legislation this year that sets this all in motion. So I think we'll need help from all of our, as I say, from the constituent organizations that make up ACIR, obviously CCM and CAPS and COST and CABE and, all of the groups that have a role to play, plus the RESCs, the RESC Alliance, and the COGS, to kind of all pull together and be on call for this type of an initiative. So I will make that effort to kind of get it moving and off the ground, but I'm going to need some help to kind of help put all that together. So if that makes sense. Yeah, Sam.
Yeah, one other thing that I think would be really helpful looking at is that there's 10 years of data on the New York State local property tax cap that they instituted in 2011, 2012, which capped municipal and school tax increases at 2%. And it has provisions for a supermajority to override it. But the Rockefeller Institute of Government in Albany has some good research into how that has impacted both the budgets, but also the approvals of school budgets. So one of their findings was it after the cap, municipal budgets really stayed to that 2% a year, but at the same time, school budgets passed more readily. Because having something to push down on increases made increasing taxes a little bit more difficult, which then incentivized making some more difficult decisions on spending. And the idea here is you don't make tax increases impossible, you just make it a little bit more difficult, and then it incentivizes making some other decision that might be a little bit more difficult than raising taxes.
Thanks for that. I think I was aware too of a similar analysis in Massachusetts when they did Proposition 2.5. And I thought one of the other outcomes of that analysis was that more affluent communities would do the super override of the 2.5% because they were willing to spend the money on education in ways that other towns may not, which perversely kind of created more of a disparity between wealthy towns and less wealthy towns, because the wealthier towns just agreed to do stuff that the poorer towns couldn't do.
And they already do that today.
You have
towns and wealthy towns today. They will always spend more because they're more comfortable spending more. So that is an issue. But it's I don't know if it necessarily. I think putting a little bit more resistance in the raising the taxes then maybe fertilizes more conversation in the town.
Is
it the panacea? No, because remember. The New York tax cap is 2%, or inflation, or whatever's lower. So they're now in a load of trouble, because now inflation is over 2%, and they're going to have some major problems in New York State. But during this decade of low inflation, and it was successful. So it's a useful model. And I think it's a model where you sort of create. You know, the path to raising taxes being a little bit more difficult, so you can have more of those conversations. But there, the supermajority is 60%, so it's not like 60. It's not 2/3. It's not 70. It's 60%. So it is achievable. And for municipal budgets, in New York, it would be the legislative body, which in some of our towns, of course, that's town meeting, but it would be town council or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they also exempted the five largest cities, and New York City wasn't exempted. And there were some other exemptions as well. But I think it's an interesting model of seeing how that's played out over 10 years and what and has that resulted in any cost savings on the municipal level, because there was this sort of cap put on them.
Right, right. Yep. Margaret, you're muted.
I remember what I forgot before. Someone back in the day had explained that there's something in this education statutes that you cannot reduce the school budget.
Yeah.
And I think that, not that anyone politically might want to do it someplace, but the fact that it's there sort of suggests to me that it's always going to be a straight line almost.
I when I was speaker, I fought the MBR, the minimum budget requirement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I touched that third rail many times, trying to get a reevaluation of whether that really makes sense or not. Our friends in education pushed back, mm-hmm. and it became it was difficult to move on that issue because, the argument was we want to bring the poorer towns that might be more inclined to cut education in order to balance their budgets. We want to bring them up. We want to bring them along and force them to spend what they need to make sure they have an adequate education locally, but it has this other perverse implication. Okay. Anyway, yeah.
But anyway, I had a senior moment there for a minute.
Got it. Yeah, I have many of them. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Rick.
Super quick. Everything you say in terms of our next steps and our strategy makes good sense. I do have to ask, is Mark Boughton going to be involved in any way? Can we also try to get the governor somehow to, if not be in the lead, signal somehow his support for a fuller discussion of this? Because as we've discussed in the past, honest, I think our best shot is when the governor and his top leadership think it's a good idea, or at least don't work against it, right?
Yes, I think I think Mark is still very interested in it, but and I also I don't know the and I think he would be supportive of it, but I think he also saw that he was getting resistance, and so I'm not sure if he will be, the Don Quixote out there within the administration, pressing the agenda on his own. I think it would have to come from the top down, to be honest. I'm sure we'd have others within the administration who'd be supportive, but until the governor signs off or shows interest, I don't think it's going to be led by anybody else within the administration, frankly.
Yeah, and you haven't suggested otherwise, Brendan, but I hope we can continue to try to persuade the governor that this is a good idea.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And we have his ear. I mean, I think it's not like we're out on an island somewhere. I think he has demonstrated to me that he's willing to have the conversation. So.
And I just want to piggyback on that is that without the investment of some, political capital and leadership from the very top, no matter what we put out there, there's going to be people who are going to be pushing back against it, whether it's MBR or whatever. So it's going to take some investment of some political capital, and they're going to have to be willing to invest that, because there's reasons why these things haven't been really addressed. It's because they're not easy, and right. And there will be people who will be for it, but there's also a lot of people who are going to be against any of these proposals. And so this is the time to act at the beginning of a new term, when everyone's willing to give you a little leeway. And it's going to be a lot more difficult to address these in 3 years when, you know, he might be considering a third term. So, So this is the time to upset people.
Yeah. And also, I think that the other advantage we have is that I was heartened by Laura Hoydick's comments at our last meeting of the full ACIR, that she views this as bipartisan. She's already talked to senior Republican leadership in the legislature, and they're very interested in doing this as well. So the one beauty of this is that this is not really a partisan issue. This is not going to be a Democratic initiative thrust onto everybody else. You know, this is going to be bipartisan based upon the conversation she's had. So that's really helpful, I think.
Yeah.
Jim?
Yeah, I just wanted to circle back around. You know, it seems to me that the folks with the most interest in this, with the municipalities, they're the ones in the municipalities who are paying this property tax. So it seems that we should be looking for support. Or we should at least be projecting our ideas out, our suggestions out to the municipal leaders themselves through the COGS, because they feel the burden and they must think about what they would like to see as an alternative, and how that could happen. So there might be, I don't want to say enthusiasm, but there might be a strong interest at the local level to try to have their local legislators delve into this and try to come up with some remedy for the property tax.
Well, that's why Rick and Brian, and Betsy Guerra are here to be voices, as well as Sam. And we don't have our RESC representative for today, but you know, I you're right. It's only going to be through those groups that we're really going to be able to get a message out that will be supportive of the overall agenda. I agree with you, right? All right, well, I will, I think, try to articulate, so let me recap. We've got two different tasks right now. One is to prepare a document for the governor that is data-driven and explanatory on the three topics that he asked to be briefed on. But Francis, anybody else who's interested in that, we can be sharing a draft around among us for input. But let's put that together, you know, before the end of the month, if possible, so we can kind of get that out to the governor. Data driven and clearly explained. I think that would be the goal. And then the second would be to make contact with the legislative leadership to start formulating a plan for an informational hearing, which then can help spin off some legislative initiatives this year. And I'll be taking that on as well. And maybe we can get something set up for, you know, mid-February as far as an informational hearing that will get that ball rolling. And obviously we're going to need to be touching base with all of the constituent groups that make up ACIR, as I've said before, to kind of help really sell that agenda. So with that, I know John's not here, but you know, one of the other topics on item 5 on our agenda was a an important thought that John was having about engagement of the RESCs and the COGS on what we're doing with the LGF generally. I think that's a really valuable and important thing that we can dedicate the LGF subcommittee to going forward. And I think we can articulate some different ideas about that. But given that John's not here, I'm gonna, maybe I can, my prerogative is as chairman, you know, I really don't wanna lose focus on what we're doing right now with the property tax report. I think that really has to be the primary objective right now, because time is of the essence if we're gonna get something launched this session. So what I might suggest, if everybody's in agreement, is let's put a pin in that right now until perhaps maybe next month when we have a better idea of the direction we're taking on the property tax front. And revisit it perhaps next month going forward and see where we are at that point and then take it on at that point. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay, good. So I think that's our agenda for today. The next full meeting is a week from Friday, February 3rd, and then our next subcommittee is the 21st of February. Does anybody else have any anything to add for this morning? If not, I'll let you go and keep the 15 minutes that you might have otherwise dedicated to this meeting. But we got a lot of work to do. So if folks can be aware and be available as needed over the next week or so, that would be helpful. All right. Mm-hmm. Great.
Thank you, Brendan. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, Brendan.
Thanks everybody. Everyone.